As I had mentioned earlier in this program, the previous six CDs that you've now listened to and completed were part of the first Millionaire Mentor program that I released. Because of the excellent response and the feedback that I got from that program, we were asked to release more of the same. So that's what I've done. On this CD, we're going to break things up a bit. We will now hear from Hawaiian Tropic founder Ron Rice. You will certainly enjoy this interview. After Ron, you'll hear more interviews with other millionaires, and then we'll get back to more of Manu Mitani's nuts and bolts of business and success. Ron, I want to thank you. By the way, we're with Ron Rice today, and we're in the lovely Daytona Beach area. I want to thank you. I know how busy you are, Ron. I appreciate your time for allowing us to come in and spend a little time with you to pick your brain a little bit. And I notice I know you're certainly going to influence a lot of people by some of the things you're going to share. Let me bug you real quickly just to ask you about your company. You're, of course, the founder of the Hawaiian Tropic Empire. How did you get started? Give us a little background, and I know you got a really cool story.
Well, jokingly, people ask me that question, and I tell them, I was walking down the beach, and I'm the founder owner. I found it, and now I own it.
So, there you go.
They have a hard time understanding that, but I was a poor boy. I came from the mountains of North Carolina. I moved down to the beach right after high school, and I decided there's something got to be something better than this. I was teaching school, coaching football, working as a lifeguard in the summer times, and I was making about $4,300 a year my first year teaching school. And I just said there's not vegetable beef soup, beans, you know, that'd be something in life better than that. Everybody said, save your money, save your money. One of these days you're going to find something out there, and then you're going to invest your money in it, and that's what you're going to do, you know. Or you're going to go to work for some company, kind of like my dad did.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I saved my money and saved my money. I didn't have much, but nothing ever came along. And I never saw anything at all. So finally I was sitting on my lifeguard stand, and I'm looking around, and I see the things that are on the beach, you know, which included suntan lotion, you know, floats, anything kids have, sunglasses or whatever there is on the beach. And I thought, well, even with my limited chemistry knowledge out of the University of Tennessee and where I'd gone before that to some smaller colleges, I thought, well, I can make a product as good as this or what's on the market at the time, or I can make something better. Maybe people will like it. So I dreamed up the idea, you know, here we are in Daytona Beach. I've got the old idea of women wearing French perfume, you know.
Right.
But along the way there, I took a trip out to the islands of Hawaii. I found a real cheap flight that was one of these leftover things I got real cheap. And I ventured back to the backside of the islands of Hawaii. And I saw where they call us Hollies. We're white, you know, and we're not supposed to be back there. But I took my chances with a couple of buddies, and we went back there and checked it out anyhow. And there was women breaking open baby coconuts and rubbing it on their skin. They were taking the essences of the flowers and the nuts and from the island and putting this on their skin. And I thought, man, this is a really novel idea. So I brought back the idea, sat on it for a while, and then I got a garbage can. I had no money. I got a garbage can. I took it to my shop teacher in my school, had him cut a hole in the bottom of it and make it a little filling machine of some rudimentary form, you know, and I used it as a basic filling machine for our first product, which was an oil. And that was way back in 1965, 66, along in there. And I took it out and started selling the bottles to lifeguards on the beach wagons, whatever stores would take it around the town. Not many stores would even talk to me. And that's where it all started, like that.
Very cool. Let me ask you, when you got started, what was your business for starting? I mean, what was your reason or your purpose for starting your business? Because you just didn't want to work, you know, 24/7 or whatever, 9-to-5 type of thing.
Well, it ended up being more than that, actually. It was strictly wanting a better life. I mean, I didn't have much. All I had was what everybody else has, was a little bit of time. And so I took my time and I invested it and worked hard, and it could have very well failed. I mean, I could right now be one of the better used car salesmen in town.
Right,
you know?
Right. Now, when you went to Hawaii, was there ever a moment for you that it just clicked and you said, I got something here?
Or no, not really.
It's just like, let me try it. You know, if I make, you know, extra $20,000, $50,000, I'm cool with that?
Mm-hmm. It was like I said, with the women using French perfume. You know, you don't have to go all the way to France to get it. You pay $5, $10 for a bottle, and you put it on, and you're in France, you know. So it's the same kind of thing with here we are in the Hawaiian Islands. I've had women call me up and tell me stories about that they take a bottle of our Royal, which has got the real exotic fragrance, and they'll drop it in their bathtub and sit back and close their eyes, and they're instantly in Hawaii.
How about that?
Or back to the beach, wherever they go, to Myrtle Beach or wherever.
Very cool. So at the outset, when you started your business, how confident were you? Because obviously, I'm assuming you didn't have any business training about marketing or
none at all.
Finances. And so give me kind of step me up on how you started learning this. Obviously, you sold the stuff by on your own to start off with, right?
Well, yeah. I came up through natural and physical science. I was poor in English. I was poor in all the other areas except for math and science. In fact, that's what I taught in high school.
Oh,
those
okay.
those eight years I worked in Miami and Daytona Beach and Florida area.
And you're how old at this time, roughly?
Right now?
No, at this time, when you were starting all this?
I'm probably 24.
Okay.
Yeah. And like I said, all I had was time, and it was just a matter of investing the time because I had nothing else. And it was just an idea, and I thought, well, you know, I can go out and sell a few bottles myself, even my little investment in my bottles, and I can sell that much even if I had to go out on the beach myself and do it, which is pretty much what I was doing at the time.
Too cool. All right. At what point did you start feeling successful financially?
Well, about 7 years, really, before I realized that it was going to. I knew it was instantly or pretty soon afterwards, I knew it was going to do something.
Right.
But it was about 7 years before I realized we were going to the big time. And when I'm talking about the big time, I'm talking about where we are today, like mass sales worldwide. And we sell in 186 countries in the world right now.
Wow.
And we're the second largest provider of suntan products in the world. We make over 300 brands of products for other companies. We make about 17 brands of suntan lotion
Wow.
for other companies. We probably for the last 15 years, we've turned worldwide in all our endeavors better than $200 million a year.
Unbelievable.
And so it's been well paid off.
So what about that seventh year, though? Was it all of a sudden somebody gave you a big contract, or you? I mean, what?
No, it's just that our sales were really taking off, and we could see that the big stores were finally interested in us. They were willing to deal with us. They were willing to give us vendor numbers. And in today's world, it's very difficult for anybody to do what we did as we did it then, because to get a vendor number in a major store would be just impossible.
All right. So tell me now the pain that you had to go through, because obviously there's going to be a lot of people listening that want to aspire to become more successful financially. What were the tough times between, say, year one and year five, six, or seven or so, the mental struggles that you had to go through, and when did you feel it at the point that you were just really totally committed to this? No matter what, you know, no matter what happens, you're not going to give this up. Even though you got some rough times, you're going to go with it all the way.
Well, you got to remember, at the time I created it, I was teaching school, coaching football, lifeguarding in the summertime. And then a lot of those people were the ones that came along with me. I brought them along with me, former coaches, former teachers, former lifeguards,
cool. Right.
Who are all around the world right now selling for me to this day.
Wow.
And in fact, my very first person that came with me was a football coach who's assistant coach, in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And I wrote him a letter. I couldn't even afford to call him up. I wrote him a letter to ask him if he wanted to become involved. And that was back in 68, I think.
Awesome.
So it's... When did we...
What were the tough times? I mean, what did you have to...
Tough times.
What was the price that you had to pay? I teach people that for anything you want to get in life, you got to give something up. What did you have to give up?
I guess one of the most disappointing things to me would be the people who cheated me, the people who didn't pay their bills, the people who I thought were my friends and didn't become friends. In today's world, if someone comes to me wanting money, if I give it to them, I tell them right on the spot, I don't want this money back. Don't ever come to me again for more. I'll give it to you now. But don't ever come back asking for more, because I know that in many cases you'll lose a friend. The money will be more important to them than the friendship. You know, it's sad to say that, and then you'd almost say, well, if it turns out that way, you don't want them as a friend anyhow. But you don't know until it happens.
Yeah. And what were some of your financial challenges? How did you? I mean, there had to be a point where you needed more money, maybe, or
well,
how did it? How,
you know,
how did
actually, it, that was a blessing. The fact that I had no money was an absolute blessing, because I was able to create the product and build it from scratch. It was almost like a snowball rolling down the hill. You buy enough to make two and sell them, and you get enough to make four, and then you buy four and you get enough to make 8, 16, and 32, and right on down the line. And that's how it grew, and it became a cult following. You remember back in the old days when airline pilots would carry six packs of Coors beer back across into the east, because
Coors only sold
in the west.
Right.
They didn't sell anything west east of the Mississippi. You'd see people walking through airports carrying six packs of beer. Well, that was amazing for me to see that, and the same thing happened with our product. It was a cult following. People couldn't get it. They couldn't, and they'd find it. They'd talk about it. One woman went into Canada. She found it in a store in Canada. We had one count up there. She bought the entire display, bought every bottle, and took it and gave it to our friends. We got an emergency call from the druggist up there in this particular store. Says, ship me three displays right now, just as quick as you can get them up here. And that's when I knew that we'd become a cult following kind of thing. You know,
good feeling.
Coming
isn't
right off the beach, yeah.
Yeah, give me some other things that you had to pay some of the prices.
Well, I think the not to change the subject, but I think one of the most interesting things in the development and the I guess the strata of how we developed, how we came along, is we did something that probably no other company's ever done, or none that I know of. We went from the beach straight to the high fashion department stores, and that was just a stroke of luck because one of my reps up in New England got some contacts with Macy's and Gimbel's and some of the big stores up there.
Nice.
We were able to give them an exclusive and let them sell, and they made big newspaper ads. We couldn't afford newspaper ads. We had no money to buy things like this, and we didn't even have the know-how to do this. And we were able to sell to these high fashion stores, and they made a feature out of us and put us in full page newspaper ads. Man, we loved it.
Wow.
I mean, we weren't selling a lot of product, but back in those days to us, it was a lot of product, you know. And then we filtered down. We came on down to the Penney's and Sears level. And when we got to the Penney's and Sears level, we lost the high fashion stores, you know. And then years and years and years later, we filtered down from the Penney's and Sears on down to where we are today in the Walmarts, Kmarts, and all what's called the mass merchandisers.
Right.
And that's where you want to be because that's where the dollars are.
How did you take the thinking if you lost a big account? I'll give you an example. I've got something going on, and in fact, it happened today that I may lose an $80,000 deal, which is, you know, for me, it's a pretty decent amount of money. How did you handle that mentally if somebody says, hey, we lost this account for whatever reason? I mean, because if you lose an account in your industry, especially when you're young in it, that could mean, you know, $10,000, $50,000, $100,000.
Well, true, but then in our business, the buyers come and go.
Mm. And buyers that buy
for the chains.
For the chains. Okay,
yeah,
I got you. Okay,
they
not your end user.
One of the great things for us is that you know, we're a very humble company, a very humble group, and all my people had no money. In fact, if anybody came to me and had money from the start, I wouldn't even take them into the organization. I wanted people that had no money. I wanted people that needed or hungry and had the enthusiasm.
You made a conscious effort for that?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And most of my people, like I said, they were high school football coaches and teachers and lifeguards just like me, and they didn't have any money. And that was perfect because they had all the desire in the world to go out and just set the world on fire and sell the product, you know.
Very good. I like that one. So now, how do you define success? I mean, I know you got financial, spiritual, and so forth, but just you pick whatever you want out of the hat.
Well, you know, I've said in past interviews that one of the great things is to meet the achievers of the world, to meet the movers and shakers, the people that have achieved and done something. And that's really a real blessing in a way, because by doing what my company, myself, and we've managed to accomplish, I've been able to meet a lot of important people and interesting people, and you learn from them also.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing to me right there.
So what have these people taught you? Is there something that sticks out of your head that, you know, no names needed, but if you have any, great, that this person years ago taught you this and recently you learned this? What are some thought processes that people shared with you that was like that aha moment that helped you in your business?
I have a lot of people come to me, and these are very famous people. I'll give you a good example is Gene Summons, for instance, the lead singer at Kiss.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant businessman. His wheels are turning all the time. This guy, people don't know this, you know, they think of him as the guy with his tongue out,
right,
and
right,
Hellraiser and all this, but this guy is just an absolute genius.
Smart guy.
And very smart guy. And a lot of the people out there, a lot of the actors and movie stars. I was on the phone yesterday, Edward James almost called me up, and I mean, he's one of the finest actors there is, you know, and we were talking about this, that, and the other. And a lot of these people, they it's not necessarily that they want to get in business, it's that they see opportunities, and they see ideas, and they want to perpetuate this, you know. And there's so many that are not good.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they necessarily
right.
bring them on, but I get so many. For instance, I'll call up my vice president, who's in charge of marketing, who's an absolute genius. His name is Jack Surratt, and he comes up with all our new ideas. And I'll say, hey, Jack, I've got a sweeping, incredible new idea for you. And he goes, the back scratcher, you know, the back applicator.
Yeah.
Everybody in the world comes up with the idea of the back applicator.
Yeah, right.
Before I even get the words out of my mouth, he's already saying, back applicator, that's a great idea, let's do it.
And that
it's an inside joke.
Yeah, so when he tells you that, it's stay away from it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, gotcha, interesting. What would you say, Ron, are your strengths as a businessman and your weaknesses?
Well, weaknesses definitely are, I had never had a course in business. never had a course in anything except natural science, physical science, chemistry, math, which is what I taught in school. That's my strong points, I guess. My strongest point is being able to read people and understand them. I know what they're thinking. I know their motivations. I just have a real keen sense of picking the right people to work with me and the ones to stay away from. And I haven't always been right in that, successful, but most cases, yes. And pure honesty, because you never have to look over your shoulder.
There you go.
You do that, you never have to look over your shoulder. Never have to worry about. I've had buddies who they couldn't do anything but dishonest work.
Yep.
And they're always looking over their shoulder and scared to death somebody's going to come up and stab them in the back. You know, I don't owe anybody a penny, and I never will.
Very cool. So, with regards to your strengths, other than being able to read people and so forth, what about your strengths as a whole in the company, how you're directing your company and so forth? How hands-on are you? Because I know a lot of people, and I'm sure you do too, that they become very successful, they want to let it go, and they put everybody else in charge. They're not hands-on anymore, and it folds, or they steal from them and so forth.
Well, no, I've managed to get really, really good people working for me. And it was hard for me in the beginning to delegate authority, but after I did, I've got really good people. You pay them decently. You respect them and help work with them as much as you can. But I'm only one person. I can only do so much. And my role, really, my strengths lie in publicity, advertising, public image, that kind of thing. And so that's where I spend most of my time. I leave the everyday grind up to them, the manufacturing, the purchasing, the shipping, and all the problems that go with it, the financing, and the things that I'm weak in, I leave that up to them and let them do that. But I do check on them. I mean, I keep up.
Sure.
They report to me. I'm never as far away, any further away than the telephone.
Right.
They sometimes come to me and they say, we got to sit down and have a meeting. And I say, well, have you changed? Do you look any different? And they go, no. And I say, well, I haven't either. I say, pick up a picture of me, and I'll pick up a picture of you, and we'll talk on the phone.
I love that
and
one.
We do that all the time. I never make appointments. I made an appointment with you.
Yeah,
though.
You did. Thank you. I feel privileged because I didn't have a picture of you. That's what it was. So you make sure we walk away without a picture today. That is very good, Ron. I like that one. I'll have to use that one. What would you say, Ron, presently motivates you? What moves you?
Let me go back one. There was one thing back in the old days that I had a philosophy that you don't spend a penny unless it brings a return. You do not spend. Of course, I couldn't afford to because I had nothing. We came from
nothing.
You
had to make it count.
And I said, you don't spend a penny unless it brings a return. You got to eat, stay alive, you know.
Right.
But other than that, just eat, sleep, and work. And it was 18-hour day working and very little eating and very little sleep. But I just want to throw that in.
No, that's good, because a lot of people realize, they don't realize, they think a lot of times they can get started into something and they just expect the return so quickly, and they expect the mentality, unfortunately, is you don't have to work for it, I want something for nothing. And as we both know, you got to stay away from that type of mentality. So what does presently motivate you?
Motivation.
I mean, you've got all this. I mean, awesome house here in Malibu, all over the world, but what motivates you now?
Well, I've got one of the greatest things in my life. I've got a 12-year-old daughter.
Yes, you do.
Who is the daughter of a well-known actress, and she ran off and left me with Jean-Claude Van Damme when my little girl was two, and it was the greatest blessing to me because she left me with her until 11. I finally let her go live with her mother when she turned 11, because I'd pretty much trained her to be a boy up to 11, and then she now knows how to be a girl. She's going to learn how to be a girl, see? So she's an amazing little girl. She's an actress herself. She's just finished her 32nd movie.
Wow.
She's been shooting movies with the Olsen twins, the last three films have been Olsen twins. And,
good for her.
She plays the nemesis. I've trained her from the time she was 2 years old. She 18 months, actually, I started her on skis, putting her on snow skis.
Really?
And she won the overall giant slalom championship 2 years ago, and then last year she won her age level with Robert Kennedy's daughter Kit Kennedy in the big celebrity challenge, another giant slalom in Squaw Valley. It was in Canada. Squaw Valley was the first one, and in Canada, Banff, Canada was the second one. So she's a real, real accomplished snow skier, and I'm real proud of her.
Good for her.
In fact, I busted my knee trying to keep up with her. I can't catch her anymore. No more of that.
Yeah, you taught her too well.
Too well.
So before her, what motivated you?
Before her?
Yeah.
Well,
what motivated you to move this business and
keep it rolling? That was 11 or 12 years ago, I guess. So before that, it was just perpetuating and keeping things going as efficient as possible. And You know, I got a lot of employees. I got over 2,000 employees.
Wow.
So I got to make sure these people do well, make sure that they have good lives. They got kids going to college,
yeah,
and so on, and I want to make sure they do well. And that was probably one of the great motivations. Success, succeeding, make sure that they are taken care of.
Yeah, that's what I see in you, which I don't see in a lot of people that I spend time with, not the people that I interview because I don't want them on here, but you do have a true caring about other people.
Well, thank you.
Because I guess if you don't do that, it comes out easy that you're a me person. And the fact that you care about other people, that is an incredible motivation, as opposed to a lot of people, they just focus, well, I want this, I want that, and so forth. But that's a good motivation to help other people.
Well, that'll be a very lonely person in the long run.
Yeah, good point. Very good point. So what would you say, Ron, is the most important mindset to being financially successful? What's the mindset?
Mindset, well, I guess you have peace of mind if you know you finally become successful and you're past the point of having to worry about day-to-day expenses and worrying about where the next money is going to come from to make this particular thing happen. You know, we stay in our area. You know, we don't get outside of our area. We stay with beach items. We stay with the suntan products. We don't manufacture tractors or bulldozers.
Right.
We try to get out into the outside fields, you know. So we're very careful.
Very smart. Why is it important for you to not have allowed your success to get to your head? Because I know when I first met you, I guess it was a Celebrity Invitational in Turks and Caicos a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was like a statement that you had on the back of your card, maybe. I'm not too sure. But it had something to do with, no, it was a bio I had read on you because you had sponsored the program.
Mm-hmm.
How one of the things that kind of your pet peeves is people who become successful financially and they become jerks and it gets to their head. And I was quite impressed, I have to tell you, that because I'm not the person that when somebody first meets me, I give them my home phone. When I first met you, you gave me your card with your home phone number on it.
Mm-hmm.
So what's, you know, you're very down to earth. And why is it important not to allow your success to, you know, ruin you, if you will, like it has done some people?
Well, unfortunately, I've had a few people in my organization let that happen to them. And I call it they read their own press and believed it. And that's a problem. And they
explain that. How would you define that?
Well,
to
they
me,
changed.
That
I mean, they started out as maybe a smart person, a humble person, and then all of a sudden they made money and they decided that they were better. They just got this attitude they were better than everybody else. And that I can't take. I can't have people around me or in my organization like that. They seem to find a way to weed themselves out.
Right. Here's a crazy question. Why are you not better than other people?
Well, I may be better in some ways, and because I was very lucky and managed to parlay an idea into something that makes money. But just because you got money, that doesn't make you necessarily a better person in any way. You got your good people and you got your bad people.
Yeah.
And money can't buy happiness, but it can make misery a whole lot easier.
How do you maintain your balance?
Try not to eat so much.
No, your other balance.
That's a problem.
balance of life and all that other good stuff.
Keep a lot of pretty secretaries around, like that one walking over there.
Bye, pretty one over there. We'll see you. But yeah, how do you keep your balance? So, I mean, I would see for a lot of people, it'd be easy to get caught up in the lifestyle that you have because you have a pretty cool lifestyle.
One thing I do, I stay pretty secluded. I guess I learned this from Julio Iglesias, who's one of my best friends. He used to have me come around, and I wondered why he had me come around. Well, we had a lot of pretty girls around, you know, but his motivation was to have them be around him so he could shield himself off from all the autograph seekers and people that wanted photographs and so on. After a while, I pretty much found myself doing the same thing.
You know? Have your own little world.
Because you don't really have time for all that.
Yeah, you're constantly going. I know that.
The time's all you got, and you have very little of it.
Yeah. So do you spend a lot of time, you know, goofing off, watching TV, or what's your schedule like? Well, when do you usually wake up? Do you use an alarm to wake up? I know if it's different because you travel all over the world.
No, I don't have any schedule at all. I may get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I may work till 3 o'clock in the morning. I may not sleep at all. I may not even eat. I may eat too much. I have no schedule. Irregularity is regularity to me. I have no schedule whatsoever. I travel all the time. I'm in and out of cities. Very independent. I can rent my own car, drive where I want to go. I will not ride in limos. I hate limos. I hate to be catered to and pampered. I hate that worse than anything. I'll stay in mediocre hotels. It doesn't matter to me as long as I got a bed and a nice clean bathroom and a place. It's fine with me. You know, I'm not one of these people that has to have the nicest of everything, even though I can afford it 100 times over.
Sure. Yeah. Very good. I like that. Let's change gears just to hear. Let's talk about the customers, because obviously without customers, neither one of us are anything. What's a customer mean to you?
Oh, they mean everything. It's whoever coined the word, the customer's always right. They couldn't have made a truer statement. You know, the customer means everything. In fact, in our market, I would think our customer level would only be 5% or less of the total market.
Wow.
It's a very, very small percentage of the market. And if you got a customer, you got to treat them right. We gear our advertising, our publicity, our efforts toward the youth, because we figure if you get them when they're young, you got them all their life.
Mm. Yeah. That's smart. How important is marketing to you?
Marketing is very important. I lean towards sports. I mean, I played sports. Like I said, I played it, and then I coached football. 8 years I was out there doing that, and I was making no money, but I was having a great time. I really, really loved it. And the kids come back today and call me coach, you know, and that's kind of fulfilling a little bit, you know, even though I don't dwell on it. Sports was my life, and I love it, and I hate to see it change into what's happening in today's world, but that's the way it's evolved, you know. That's what I'm interested in. Yeah, clean sports.
Right. Now, what about if somebody came to you and they wanted to get into business, they just wanted to be more successful? What, I mean, of course, that's an open-ended question, but where do you suggest that they start?
Okay, well, I always tell them, look ahead and look behind. You can anticipate where you're going. You can look behind, and history repeats itself. If you can study where other people have failed or other people have succeeded, and you can read about their stories and you can see what they did, everything's an eye opener more and more and more, and you can understand what somebody did, where they started. I mean, one of the most successful men in the world probably started wrapping paper boxes or taping paper boxes in some mail room or working who knows what. You know, I was putting bottles in a crate myself, back making 75 cents a day in the afternoons after school, going over and taking all their old dirty bottles and sticking them in crates and getting them ready to ship out to the bottling company. And that's sitting in a dirty little room with a dirt floor. That's where I worked when I was in junior high school. It's just a part-time thing. Then I worked in a drive-in restaurant delivering food when I was in high school for a short time. I worked at a hotel all night long and a kids' camp in the daytime, trying to make enough money to buy my first car. And when I was a kid, we lived on a mountaintop in North Carolina, and I used items from the mountain to sell at my roadside stand you hear about the lemonade stand. Well, this was a big stand. I mean, this wasn't a lemonade stand. This had everything. I had nuts, and I had cracked nuts, and I had whole nuts, and I had Christmas wreaths at Christmas time. I had grape. I had a big grape orchard. I had 40-some apple trees. We sold bushels of apples. I had my own cider mill. We churned them up and made cider. I'd sell the gallons. I'd take orders for 5-day-old, 4-day-old, 3-day-old, 2, you know, just like it almost turned into, they called it Applejack. It was liquor at that time. I didn't know. I was only 8 to 12, 15 years old, you know, during that time when I was running my roadside stand. We had peach trees. Not too well in peaches because we were a little far north, but pears. We had just about anything you could think of that could come off a mountain garden or a fruit vineyard, you know, and I sold it all in my roadside stand. I had animals. I sold rabbits. I had 40 dogs.
And you owned all this?
Owned it all, yeah.
At how old?
7 years old to 15. I did it, started around 7 years old doing this.
Wow.
Had my older brother and my younger sister working for me. I'd pay them to come help me whatever had to be done, you know.
How about that?
We'd sell Christmas wreaths at Christmas, and my brother would carry the Christmas wreaths around on a cross, and I'd go up to the door and stand there and try to sell them, and my little sister would stand back here with a real shabby outfit on, looking so poor, and people felt sorry for us, and they'd buy these.
Yeah, you sound like you do know marketing.
It didn't take long to figure that one out.
Back in the studio here, I think you'll agree that Ron is really an interesting person to listen to. I mean, you talk about somebody who started from nothing. I mean, this guy started from scratch. You talk about rags to riches. Now, on the next CD, we'll take some time to see what information and tools of success that he shared with us in this interview. So let's not stop here.